street and people...
You got promoted.
A call to order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is Wednesday, February 2nd, and we are convened for the purposes of having an informational meeting regarding Oregon's health insurance rate review processes, also to have a public hearing and possible work session, very most likely a work session, on what we felt were some pretty low-hanging fruit on Senate Bills 52 and 53, and then we will also be introducing a number of committee bills later on in the session. To just tee this up a little bit, I told you all that I went to the Senate President in the interim, and I said we should have a Small Business Development and Small Business Protection Committee that would not only deal with economic development ideas, but also address issues that small business go through in facing the challenges of whether it's anti-competitive behavior in the marketplace or just the challenges of trying to purchase services when there are very few providers of that service in a particular market. And I think we all agree, and most of you have been involved in running your own small business, that that healthcare is perhaps the quintessential challenge for the small business person, whether they are an entrepreneur on their own or a small business. And the state of Oregon, as you know, has the authority to approve or disapprove health insurance rates in the small group, which means 2 to 50 employees, as well as in the individual markets. And so over the next several meetings, we'll be just taking inventory of that process and seeing how it performs, and then perhaps we can figure out as a committee whether or not there are things we can do to improve it as we go along. With that being said, any comments from the committee before I bring up our presenters? All right, I would like to bring then to the table Teresa Miller, Insurance Division Administrator at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and Scott Fitzpatrick, Insurance Division Actuary for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Should we call you Administrator Miller? Is that?
Please call me Teresa. That would actually be great.
Teresa, take it away.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's good to see you all again. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller, and I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm very pleased to be with you today to talk about our health insurance rate review process. At your request, Mr. Chair, I have with me today Scott Fitzpatrick, who is one of the department actuaries. He's a life and health actuary. Day-to-day, Mr. Fitzpatrick reviews Medicare supplement and long-term care policies. He does not review individual and small group policies that we'll be talking about today, at least on a regular basis, but we wanted to honor your request, and so he is here today, and following my presentation, he'll be walking through a rate filing. I also just want to introduce Jim Swenson, who's behind me. Mr. Swenson is a former administrator of the Insurance Division a few years ago, and he was most recently with the department in 2008 and 2009. He was a technical advisor for the department and worked very closely with our health insurance rate review process at that time. And he has rejoined the department as an actuary, and he reviews individual and small group rate filings that we'll be talking about today. So I thought I'd talk today about what we look at in reviewing health insurance rates in the individual and small group markets that we regulate. And as I'll mention in a minute, these markets only cover about 11% of Oregonians. So it's just good to kind of keep that in mind. And I'll provide information on current rates and trends in these markets. And then I'll talk about ways that we are continuing to improve our process, particularly as the federal government makes additional resources available to us through a multi-year grant opportunity that was part of the federal health reform law. Although our rate regulation probably gets the most public attention, it's actually a small part of what we do, but many of our other functions support our rate review process. So before we get into the details of rate regulation, I thought I would actually just touch on our broader duties and the insight that they provide into the Oregon insurers who provide most of the health insurance in Oregon. So I'll start with financial regulation. While nobody calls us these days with concerns that insurers aren't making enough money, that's probably no surprise to you, our role in ensuring that companies can pay claims is perhaps the ultimate consumer protection. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, there were enough insolvencies nationwide that our National Organization of Insurance Commissioners, we refer to them as the NEIC, they started an accreditation program to ensure uniform standards for analyzing insurer solvency. And Oregon is charged with seeing that Oregon-based insurers are solvent, and other states are charged with doing the same with their companies. So to ensure that companies possess and maintain the financial resources needed to meet their obligations to policyholders, we monitor insurer finances, and we also determine which insurance companies should be allowed to do business in Oregon to begin with. And we do this through the application of national standards that have been incorporated into our state laws and regulations. The review of a company's financial soundness and compliance with statutes and record-keeping standards is primarily carried out through the department's financial examination and analysis process. A financial examination occurs on-site and is an in-depth review of an Oregon insurer. By law, the department must conduct these exams at least once every 5 years, and generally we conduct these exams once every 3 years. We do have the authority to conduct them more often if we determine that that's necessary. Oregon health insurers also submit quarterly and annual financial statements to the department, and the department's financial analysts review these statements to evaluate each insurer's status and operational health over time. This detailed financial scrutiny really does give us an intimate knowledge of our insurers and their finances, and these companies together make up more than 90% of Oregon's commercial market. One of the questions that we get on a very regular basis is, how do you verify the accuracy of a company's data? How do you know that your rate filing data is good data? And one of the reasons I wanted to start with our financial regulation process is because this really is one of the key checks and balances in terms of verifying company data. Part of the financial exam process actually includes a random sampling of claims. We actually select certain claims and we follow them from the time they were sent to the insurance company by the policyholder to the time the insurance company pays its share of the bill. And we ensure that these transactions match what the company reported. And additionally, when our actuaries receive a rate request, our financial analysts provide the latest information on the company to our actuaries. So our financial analysts and our actuaries actually work very closely together, often comparing data to ensure the accuracy of the data reported to the department. The department also regulates the terms and conditions of insurance policies by reviewing them to ensure they include all required policy language and provisions, including health insurance mandates, everything necessary to constitute a complete health insurance policy. We have a staff of consumer advocates who work with consumers to resolve individual insurance problems. In 2010, the division received approximately 3,600 complaints, 18,000 questions, and recovered approximately $2 million for consumers. And when we see a recurring problem or trend, it's referred to our market analysis staff who do a more in-depth investigation. And we also have broad enforcement powers to address issues as they come up, including the ability to impose fines, require disgorgement of profits, issue cease and desist orders, suspend or revoke licenses or certificates of authority, and even seek criminal penalties. A good example of our enforcement authority is our action against Bankers Life, which addressed the sale of unsuitable annuities to seniors. We learned of the problem through a contact through our consumer advocates. Our market analysis staff did an investigation. Ultimately, we imposed a $150,000 fine against the company. We obtained restitution for those people who were sold annuities inappropriately. We revoked the licenses of several agents who'd sold the products inappropriately and required the company to make substantial changes in their business practices going forward. We also have rulemaking authority to address a variety of insurance issues and have recently addressed the issue of annuity suitability, in fact, through rule. And when we can't address issues through other means, we make policy recommendations to the legislature to address consumer concerns. A good example was our legislation in 2009 to address the most common issues we see through our consumer complaint process around automobile total loss claims, and the legislature passed that bill. So, speaking of legislation, the department also brought forward last session and this body passed House Bill 2009, which really did make Oregon's rate review law one of the strongest laws in the country. And our law is now serving as a model for the rest of the country as many states are working to either improve their current rate review processes or develop processes from scratch. And just to put this conversation in perspective, only about half of the states currently have what we refer to as prior approval processes in both the individual and small group markets that we'll be discussing today, which essentially means that the regulator must affirmatively approve a proposed increase before that increase can be implemented by the insurer. The one final thing I would note is that while House Bill 2009 did strengthen our rate review statutes in our process, Oregon had a very strong process prior to 2009 as well. As I mentioned, a number of states still don't have prior approval processes in place, and Oregon has had one in place for many years. So I mentioned, and I think, Mr. Chair, you also mentioned, the department must approve insurance rates in the individual, portability, and small group health insurance markets. Together, these markets cover only about 12% of Oregonians. I always like to remind everyone of that because sometimes I think we mistake this process for impacting a lot more people than it does. But obviously, these are important people. It's 12% of Oregonians. We don't review or approve rates for large groups. And I think primarily that's because large employers negotiate typically their benefits and rates directly with insurers. And I think there's also some concern that regulation of large group would encourage these groups to self-insure, which would exempt them from state regulation altogether. So before I talk about how we evaluate rate change requests, I just want to give you a little background on small business rates and the rating rules that apply to the small group market. In Oregon, we're among a handful of states that uses modified community rating in the individual and small group markets. Insurance companies must pool all of their small group employers so that a rate charged to an individual small employer is based on the pooled experience of the insurer's entire book of business in that market segment. So a rate for a particular small employer generally reflects increases in medical claims for all that insurer's small employers. However, rates can vary based on a limited number of factors, and they must stay within what we call a 3-to-1 rate band. So in other words, rates are allowed to vary from small employer to small employer based on certain factors, but the most expensive rate charged to a small employer cannot be more than 3 times as much as the least expensive rate for the same benefits.
Okay, can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
Teresa, so if the rate filing says the increase is going to be, say, 9%, does mm-hmm. that mean that some people could get up to 3 times as much as that?
Potentially. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the later part of my presentation, but the 9% is just an average, which means there are people who are getting higher or lower increases.
Okay.
Exactly.
Point of clarification, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Boquist.
Okay, so what you really just, you said two answers here, Teresa.
Sorry.
You asked me. It's a 1.5 variable up or down, or is it a 3 times?
Oh, I'm sorry.
If you said 9% average, that would mean that you could go 1.5 up or 1.5 down, basically, if it's 3-to-1. Is that correct?
I apologize. So you were asking if somebody could get 3 times 9%? Scott, you're the actuary.
I would say no. But
that would be too high.
No,
they work out the numbers.
Because of age banding, there's potential that an individual could receive a higher increase than the average in the school. But the 3-to-1 banding that takes place in Oregon is a very tight band relative to what most states permit. Most states permit almost an unfettered range of age adjustments. There is a great deal of pooling that takes place in the Oregon market because of the law and regulation.
Thanks. And then, Ms. Miller, could you inform the committee that Mr. Swenson's name for the record? And
for the record, that was Jim
Swenson. Perhaps you could restate
Swenson.
It. Yes.
Actuary for the department.
Okay.
All right. So I mentioned that small employer rates can vary based on several factors, so these next two slides just list those factors. Benefit design, geography, age of the employees, and their covered dependents, employer contribution, wellness programs, customer loyalty, employee use of tobacco, family composition, and expected claims. But expected claims is limited to a 5% variation either way. So now we'll get into our rate review process. That was all just an overview. So now we'll talk about what we do in terms of reviewing these filings when they come in. When we receive a rate filing, it may be anywhere from 30 pages to 130 pages. When we get that filing, we have 10 days to determine if it's complete. In other words, did we receive all the documents that are required to be submitted with that filing? Because of the technical nature of this process and the fact that historically it is one that involves primarily actuaries, no offense to my colleagues, but sometimes they speak a slightly different language than those of us who are not actuaries. And one of the greatest challenges, honestly, that we've been facing and that all states are facing today is trying to find ways to make rate review processes more transparent and more understandable to the public, particularly given the intense interest in this process that's developed over the last few years. Oregon has taken a number of very important steps to work to increase the transparency of our process and work to make it easier to understand. We adopted rules in early 2010 that make the entire rate filing public. So we now post the entire rate filing on our website as soon as it's deemed complete. And we've also used part of our federal grant, the first year of our federal grant, to fund the consumer group Osberg to represent consumers in commenting on key rate requests. We also have a 30-day public comment for all rate requests. And additionally, there are several pages of a rate filing that are really designed to help consumers understand the request and the ultimate decision. I'd be lying, though, if I didn't tell you that this has been one of the greatest challenges that we have faced. It just has been. Having said that, it's clearly a priority for the department, and it has been for some time, and we've made great strides on this and, in fact, really do lead the country in our efforts, as painful as perhaps they've been. Okay. So once the entire filing is posted on our website, that triggers a 30-day public comment period. Policyholders can sign up on the department's website to receive an email when their insurer files a rate request, and then they can go view the entire rate filing and then comment on the request if they so choose. And those comments are then posted to our website. Because every rate filing really does tell its own story, the department develops and then posts on our website a summary of the rate filing, listing the key factors in our decision and why we did what we did. And consumers who've then signed up on our website get another email that we've made a decision, and it links them then to that rate filing decision summary. So within the rate filing...
Yes. Senator Boquist.
Could you go back one slide?
Sure.
Just ask, I understand the rate, I understand your process right here, but you just said you're going to we then email out to people who signed up on the web page.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's just say I have insurance from Acme Insurance Company, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they put in for a rate request. I don't know that they put in for a rate request. I just had this happen to me personally where I got the notice after the fact, you know, that, you know, they're going to increase their insurance, so on and so forth. So how does a consumer, unless some consumer is watching it and checking your webpage every 30 days, there's no way that the average consumer, small business owner, less than 25 or less than 50 employees, knows that this is coming down the pike. You know it, and if Osberg is monitored, they know it, but it's after the fact and it's all done that the actual consumer, small business, finds any information. Is that correct? Unless they're tracking it themselves.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, if you or a small business person, anyone signs up on our website, you can go to our website and under rate requests, you can say, I'm with this company, I want to see any individual filing with this company, or I want to see everything. You can check all the boxes. Once you've gone through that process, then you do get a notification. So then you would know when your insurer has requested a request, and then you'd know when we made our decision as well.
Hello, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So then I would assume it would be prudent advice to any small business in our district, given the dynamic changes of healthcare that are happening with federal law and the rest of that, that everybody ought to sign up and pay attention to what's going on here.
Absolutely.
Other than that, we're only going to know if we signed up and it's coming, because it's going to be a little late for the small business when we get it. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Okay. So within a rate filing, what do we look at? Our statute allows the department to review a number of factors to determine whether the benefits are reasonable in relation to the premium charged, and rates must be reasonable and not excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. Department actuaries rely on these two laws to answer really two basic questions about each rate filing. Number one, is the aggregate rate request justified? And number two, is the request fairly allocated among the ratepayers? To determine whether the overall rate request is actuarially supported, the division reviews a number of factors. And for each of these factors, department actuaries evaluate the reasonableness of the assumptions being made by the insurance company in light of the company's past experience, the impact on policyholders, and requests and assumptions made by other companies. And again, going back to the question of verifying company data, another check and balance occurs in the process when our actuaries review these factors in light of what information we've received from other companies, as well as data we've received in previous rate filings from that insurer. And doing that comparison helps us determine whether or not the current information we're looking at is reasonable. So let's look at the rate factors that we review. A key factor in looking at rates is what percent of the premium dollar the insurer spends on medical claims versus administrative costs and profits. In Oregon, in the individual and small group markets, insurers have been spending, on average, 85 cents of every premium dollar to pay policyholder claims. You may have heard that federal health reform will require insurers to spend minimum amounts of a premium dollar on claims or rebate policyholders. In the individual and small group markets, that number is 80 cents. So as you can see from the numbers, we don't anticipate any of our Oregon-based insurers being in the position of having to rebate money to policyholders because they don't meet that standard. Perhaps the key factor in reviewing a rate increase is a company's medical claims costs, both past and projected. This chart is based on Oregon's seven largest insurers in all markets and really shows the correlation between premium increases and increases in medical claims costs. So let's talk about increases in claims costs, or what we refer to as trend.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is that 7% or 12% or 7% of your chart? Is it the 12% you regulate, or you said the seven largest, or is that of the 12% you regulate?
So it's the seven largest insurers, Mr. Chair. We regulate the individual and small group markets. Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I apologize. We regulate the individual and small group markets. We regulate all seven insurers within those markets. This is all markets, so this is not just the individual. Right.
Okay.
So this would include large group as well. So you'll see that claims costs are the result of medical inflation and use of medical services. Medical inflation is the increase in unit cost for services ranging from hospital stays to prescription medicine to charges by physicians and other medical professionals. For example, medical inflation can be affected by changes in negotiated hospital or physician reimbursement rates. Use reflects the rate at which medical services are used and is affected from everything from the health and age of the insured population to the level of coverage, the availability of new drugs and medical technology, and changes in provider practices. Although we don't necessarily have complete data at the department, I think if you talk to insurers, you'll find that medical inflation is a much larger driver of trend. I think utilization is a much smaller component. So even though utilization may be down for a company, they may not experience a significant decrease in trend just because it may be a very small portion of the trend. As we review proposed rate increases, I do think it's important to point out that while we consider claims costs, and it's actually a very important part of what we consider, we don't regulate these costs. We don't regulate provider pay, for example. Having said that, I'll talk in a little bit about a study that we're having conducted to see if there are ways we may be able to address the underlying cost of health care through our health insurance rate review process. And recent rate filings show Oregon medical claims cost, or trend, at 12%. We also consider administrative costs, both past and projected, when reviewing a rate filing. While the bulk of premium dollars pays for medical costs, we know that every percentage point of an increase is important to consumers. And House Bill 2009 from last session gives us the tools to look at administrative expenses in much greater detail. Under the new law, rate filings now include a detailed five-year history of an insurer's administrative expenses so that we can see trends. And this information is being used to help determine whether a proposed rate is reasonable. As we review each rate filing, we also consider the company's target profit for that line of business. You'll see a slide in a minute that shows the average profit, or actually the average loss, for the lines of business that we regulate. But I just want to talk for a minute about profit in terms of the company's entire business, which is what this slide demonstrates. House Bill 2009 also gave the department explicit authority to consider an insurer's investment income, surplus, and overall profitability when reviewing a rate filing. Because companies, on average, were more profitable in 2010, and some had healthy surpluses, the department used this new authority to push back on insurer requests for significant increases in the individual and small group markets, even though insurers in some cases were losing money in these lines of insurance. In Oregon, average profit margins were around 3% in 2010, which is higher than any profit margins we've seen since 2006. However, as you'll see in a moment, these profits were earned primarily in areas other than the individual and small group markets that we regulate. And I would point out that when you look at overall company data, it includes investment income, which was actually a big part of the story in 2010. Investment income in 2010 represented 2% of the 3% you see here. Which probably isn't a big surprise.
One second, Teresa. Senator George.
I'm trying to kind of follow this logic a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So if an insurer makes, let's say, for instance, a 5% profit by holding costs down somehow, then they're actually punished because we're trying to get them back at the 2% level? I mean, in essence, what's the motivation for an insurance company to cut costs if, in essence, we're capping their profits in the market? You understand what I'm saying? So why would an insurance company ever try to cut costs?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, you're hitting on a real issue that is something we have to consider in every rate filing. And I mentioned that when we look at all these factors, you know, we look at the impact on policyholders, we look at the insurer's financial condition, and it really comes down to considering all of those factors, what makes the most sense. I will tell you that when I mentioned that we push back on some of these insurers and some of the lines of business, even though they were losing money in those lines of business. Oftentimes, a company may be losing money in a line of business, and their request that comes in the door may seek an increase that, even if we approve that entire increase, would still result in a loss. And that's a business decision, obviously, that the company is making. But part of our review does look at the impact on policyholders. And so as we look at the economy and what that's done to policyholders over the last few years, we have pushed back pretty significantly on some of these companies. Having said that, using surplus and overall profitability, and I'll talk about this in a minute, I've got a slide on this, we're trying to do that very carefully. From a regulator's perspective, I have a very hard time saying to a company, long term, it makes sense for us to keep you at either losing money or making no profit. I think that's a difficult position for a regulator to take. But on a short-term basis, when the economy is what it is, we have pushed back on some of these requests.
Yeah, follow up.
Teresa, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, so you have Sam's health insurance company, you have Bob's insurance company, and they're both supplying insurance for $1,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Bob's insurance company says, hey, if we change the way we pay doctors in this way, we can drop our costs and by $50 a month. Okay, so we can capture. So then all of a sudden, you know, overall trend goes up, but in comparison to the two companies, one company is making $50 more a month. When the rate goes up, do you guys evaluate those companies? You guys are evaluating those companies individually. So in essence, what could happen is you're like, well, you know, Bob's company is making $50 more a month, therefore we're not going to grant his rate increase, but the person who jacked their costs up or didn't watch their costs will grant theirs because they're not as profitable. So in essence, it seems like to me, from what you're saying, and I'm just not understanding it, is we're rewarding companies that don't necessarily keep their costs in check, and we punish those who are more profitable.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, it's a good question, and I think let me go a little bit further.
Okay.
We don't just consider those things. Cost containment is actually something we also do consider. So when we look at each of these companies, their situations are very different oftentimes. We've got companies who may be doing much better financially than others. If they've also implemented cost containment measures and kept their increases reasonable, that is one of the things we're looking at when we look at these rate increases. We're looking at the past history. So part of what I think you'll see if you look at our past rate filings is those companies who have had very, very high increases, we've pushed back more on those. Again, very concerned about the impact on policyholders. At the same time, though, if there's a company that's done a really good job of containing costs and they've kept their rate increases more reasonable, we've not taken a position of you can't make a profit on that. We're going to give you zero profit on that. So I think we do consider cost containment efforts as part of that.
follow up. Real quick, Trace, one last question then. So let's say, for instance, we have one company that's selling exactly the same product, can make a 10% profit. Are they punished in this mechanism, even though they're serving the customer at a higher level, they're containing costs, but their profit is 10% and the average is 1%? Are you guys trying to put a cap on what they can make, or can they make 10% and that's totally fine with you as long as they're competitive in the market?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'll be very honest with you. I would have a difficult time approving a 10% profit on our lines of business today. Having said that, though, we've not taken a policy position that we would not approve a certain percentage rate or that we're capping profits at 2% or 3% or 1%. We've not taken that position. We really do look at each rate filing for what it is given
to that company.
For that company and what they've done in terms of cost containment, what they've done in terms of keeping their rates reasonable, all of those things. So it's there's a lot of factors that we look at, and we really do look at each company individually.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Chair.
Yes. 1 second, Teresa.
Senator Moreau.
Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
These companies are private companies, and they compete with each other, though. Isn't that true?
They do.
And so if one company, spinning off of what Senator George was saying, if one company is more efficient and is able to keep its costs down, therefore offer a product at a lower cost than their competitor, then they're going to get more business. So it seems to me that there is an incentive for efficiency by the very nature that they compete with other private companies.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, you actually make a very good point. I think you're absolutely right, and it gives me a chance to make a point that I don't make in my presentation, but I think it's worth mentioning because it sets Oregon apart from other states. In many states, and the conversation we've heard at the federal level, there's often a statement made about there's no competition in health insurance in this country. That's not true in Oregon. We have 7 major domestic health companies here that really do compete with each other, and we really do have a very competitive market, which is different from most states. So that is a very good point.
Thank you. Can I ask you a question about that, though? Also, in health insurance, the degree of elasticity in demand is also important, isn't it? If you've got, 1,000 people in the health insurance plan that all have a pre-existing condition, it's not like they can jump to whatever health plan they would like to go to. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, in the individual market for people 19 and over, that's true. In the individual market, you can't jump from carrier to carrier because you still have underwriting in that market. You don't have underwriting anymore in the kids market, and there's no underwriting in small business. So for small businesses, they can move from one carrier to another without having that problem.
Right. So, I mean, you can go where you like, but it's like if you have a pre-existing condition, it's like a smoker or a heroin addict will often pay whatever the market will put out there because they don't have any other choices. Senator Bocas.
Thank you, sir. Kind of a follow-up in the same reasoning. Teresa, between this and 2 other slides back, I think, kind of running into this discussion, one of the slides way back there showed that there's 29% uninsured. So if you take
or 17%.
17% uninsured. If you go under the federal law, we're going that down that road presently. Those are going to become insured. But what really jumps out at me is, I mean, those are probably mostly smaller businesses, too. So you could be easily doing, 29% here in a couple of years. But what strikes me is the reverse of my original thinking was the antitrust issues is the single largest cost here is medical inflation. Now, under the scenario that Senator George and Senator Monroe brought out is Bob's Insurance out here has figured out how to do this efficiently. And they're obviously figuring out a way not to pay 12% inflation, because that's the real number here.
Yeah, it is.
The question is what are you allowed by the law to do, or what can you do? And I don't know, I really don't know the answer. I don't think you know the answer either. But this 12%, if Bob figured out how to make it 3%, and we in the state are paying 12% on average, that 9% is a big deal to us. How do they get to that 9%? How do they save that money? How do you make sure the other companies capitalize on those efficiencies legally, or can we do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I hope I'm at least getting somewhat at your question, but one of the things I'm most excited about in terms of where we want to go for future improvements in our process, I mentioned earlier, I think, that we are looking at conducting and will be conducting a study to see if there are ways we can use our rate review process to try to get at some of those costs. What's very clear, if you look at all this information on a day-to-day basis, is what you said is absolutely right. Healthcare costs are driving premium increases, there's no doubt, and they're driving them at a significant rate. And people can't deal with that. So what I'm actually really interested to look at is whether there are ways that we can use our process to try to get at those costs. We're trailblazers in this in many ways. There are not a lot of states who are looking at these issues, but I think it's a really interesting area to look at. And going back to our market, with such a competitive market, and if you look at Oregon's geography and some of the regional delivery systems, the more isolated regional delivery systems that we have, I think insurers don't have a lot of leverage in the negotiations with providers. And if there are things we can do in terms of requirements for insurers that put all of them on an even playing field and give them more negotiating power when they sit down with providers, that might be a way we can get at some of those costs. And that, to me, is really exciting because we might be able to actually mitigate some of these rate increases going forward if we can figure out a way to do that.
Please continue.
Okay. So going back just briefly on surplus and rate review, and going back to sort of our exchange, Senator George, we are very careful about how we use surplus and overall profitability in terms of mitigating rate increases. There's been a lot of press about use of surplus and big surpluses that some companies have, and why can't we use that to mitigate rates. We're very cautious about doing that because forcing insurers to underprice insurance long-term is not a good strategy for consumers. Ultimately, the product has to be priced to cover the cost, and so the more you create a bigger gap, that has to be made up at some point. So we are concerned not just about the consumers that are with insurance companies today, but consumers of tomorrow who might be facing some of those higher increases. So recall that the department has rate review authority in the small group portability and individual markets and that they only cover 12%. Generally speaking, Oregon carriers have much larger books of business in the large group market. Some sell other non-regulated products, Medicare Advantage, for example. You'll notice that the profit data for companies as a whole, which we saw a few slides ago, and the profit data for companies in these regulated markets is very different. It presents a very different story. Rate filings from the past several months show that Oregon carriers, on average, are currently losing 2% in the small group market and more than 5% in the individual market. And Senator George, oftentimes that's because that's what they're requesting, just so you know. Okay. I mentioned earlier that as actuaries review each rate filing, they evaluate the reasonableness of the assumptions being made by the insurance company. And here's a good example of that. As companies have modified their policies to include the new benefits required by federal reform, for example, department actuaries have been analyzing the reasonableness of the assumptions relied upon by the companies as they have tried to, as they proposed increases to cover those new benefits. In determining whether or not those companies' assumptions are reasonable, our actuaries look at the requests and assumptions made by other companies, studies, if there are any available, analyzing the impact of these new benefits, and differences in benefit design that might explain the variations in the estimated impact of these benefits. Although it's impossible to know the exact impact of these additional benefits that they'll have on a particular company or a line of business, we have reduced several requests that appear to be outliers after reviewing the data that I just mentioned. Another key issue for the division is how a rate increase is distributed among policyholders. In other words, even though we approve an average 12% increase, for example, some people will see higher increases and some will receive lower increases or even decreases. Within the past 2 years, for example, we saw our two largest insurers change their rating structures so that families with more than one child pay more. These policyholders had higher than average increases. On the other hand, families with only one child pay less and receive lower than average increases, and some even receive decreases. Insurers can also vary rates in particular geographic regions due to changes in provider agreements, and this may mean that groups in a particular region receive either higher increases or lower than average increases. So this slide shows the average rate increases in the small employer market over the last few years. And you'll see that these increases really do tend to mirror trend that we talked about earlier, the 12%.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Boquist.
Just one observation for future note, since we're the consumer affairs here. I mean, the Consumer Price Index and our dear fellow comrades over there back in the federal government in D.C. keep lecturing to us that inflation is only 2%. And we at the state continue to tie ourselves to a CPI that's nothing more than an artificial piece of garbage. Because the reality is, the costs are going up for small business, the costs are going up for the consumers, and we see it time and time again here. But the federal government keeps telling us inflation is only 2%.
No.
There's something wrong here.
That's it. Thank you for that very neutral observation. Teresa, the 12%, you're not suggesting that medical inflation across the country is 12%, are you?
Mr. Chair, actually, about a year or so ago, we had our actuary who reviews these filings. We were looking at the 12% and wondering if that was high in comparison to other states. And so we asked him to do some outreach to other states to see what are they experiencing. And what we were surprised, but what we learned was 12%, there are states with lower trend. There are also states with higher trend, and there are states with the 12%. So once we received that data back, it really struck us that Oregon is not unique in terms of a 12% trend. I think a lot of states are looking at...
But what I'm asking is, are you saying it's 12% trend in the individual small group and portability, or is it 12% statewide in all medical...
Mr. Chair, plans? We only regulate rates in the individual small group and portability markets, so my comments are limited to those. We don't see large group rates, so I don't know what's happening in terms of large group rates.
Okay, so you're saying the 12% medical inflation is just for how the things that you observe.
The 12% increase in claims costs is what we see in the individual and small group.
And also, have you had an indication of whether or not medical utilization has been going up or down in the last year?
Mr. Chair, the data I have on that is 2009 data, so I haven't been able to look at any 2010 data. So I know you've probably seen some articles recently that have been talking about what companies saw in 2010. I don't have data from 2010 that I've been able to look at, so no. Every rate request, as I mentioned before, really does tell its own story based on a company's unique position. In some recent rate filings, we have rejected insurer assumptions and approved lower rates than requested, and in others, we found the initial request to be justified and approved it as we received it. These are just three examples of recent rate filings and the decisions that we made. I won't go into detail on these because Mr. Fitzpatrick will be going through the Pacific Source filing, but these are just examples. Rate increases obviously don't tell you anything about overall rates. So to put this all in perspective, I'm including data from the federal government's medical expenditure panel survey that gives us this data on family premiums in the small group market. So you can see that Oregon is below the average. And in fact, for family premiums, Oregon is 35th, meaning only 16 states had lower premiums.
Teresa, what's the source of that?
The source of this is MEPS, the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey. And in fact, if you want to see the entire chart, it's actually included in the health report that I provided you. It's the very last page of the health report.
And is that the most recent survey?
I believe it is. Although we do have a very strong rate review process in place, we are always working to improve it, particularly as the federal government is making additional resources available to us. The federal reform law included a $250 million multi-year grant program to assist states in either developing or improving their current rate review processes. The department received $1 million for federal fiscal year 2010 to further enhance our process. And this grant funding is allowing us to increase consumer input on rate requests by funding a consumer advocacy organization to provide regular comments on rate filings, increase the scrutiny of rate filings and insurance company data by hiring an additional actuary and market analyst, require insurers to provide detail on medical claims, and fund the study I mentioned earlier looking at ways we might be able to use our rate review process to address the underlying costs of health care. We anticipate receiving more information about the 2011 or Cycle 2 rate review grant opportunity in the near future. So this will be another opportunity to continue enhancing our process. At this point in time, given our current robust statutory authority and all the significant changes that we've made and continue to make, we don't see any need for further statutory changes, but we do continue to look for ways to improve our process, and we'll continue to do so within existing authority. I would be remiss if I didn't end on this note. If we're going to address the increases in insurance premiums, we have to find a way to get at health care costs. The legislature took an important first step towards this goal in passing House Bill 2009 last session, which has the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research beginning to collect claims information and creating an all-payer, all-claims database to provide the state comprehensive data about the quality and cost of health care in Oregon. This information will allow you as policymakers to monitor the state's efforts to reduce healthcare costs and drive delivery system improvements. For our part, we'll be conducting the study that I've mentioned to see if there are ways that we can use our rate review process to try to get at the underlying cost of healthcare. Once that study is completed later this year, we may have ideas of how we can further improve our process, and we'll certainly come back and share those with you. And finally, the Oregon Health Authority recently released an action plan to address issues surrounding cost, quality, and access to health care. While the federal government, in their Federal Reform Act, addressed issues relating to insurance coverage and access, they really left it up to the states to take the next steps on lowering costs and improving quality. And these are the areas that the Oregon Health Authority is focused on. By addressing the primary driver of health insurance premiums, the cost of health care, I'm hopeful that the Oregon Health Authority's efforts, along with perhaps the study that we're doing, will assist us in curbing the double-digit premium increases that are facing Oregonians today. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Fitzpatrick.
Yes.
Thank you. Teresa, one last question. On that all-payer, all-claims database, mm-hmm. in kind of preparation for this, I talked to a number of medical providers and asked what do they see in their offices, why are they billing insurance companies more, and they said that they, at least some of them anecdotally said that they're seeing really, really low returns for Medicaid, Medicare, or from different programs. And what they're doing is
cost shifting
to the private insurance plans for underfunding on the public sector. So does this study right here also gather what the public providers are paying to the medical providers, or is it just private health insurance? Because it seems like to me that one of the big things anecdotally, and I don't have any evidence for this, but just anecdotally, one of the big drivers is cost shifting from the public sector health insurance to the private sector health insurance, and it's really basically a completely hidden tax.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, you're exactly right on that. Are you asking about the all-payer, all-claims database
right.
or our study?
Both, I guess. The question is that when this is done, are we going to have that piece of information of what the cost shift is? It seems like to me the cost shift is a really big issue here.
It absolutely is, and it's a good question. I don't know that these studies will get at that. I mean, you mentioned it's the hidden tax. It really is the hidden tax, and I don't know that either of these. I'm less familiar with the all-payer, all-claims because our office isn't directly doing that. Our study won't be looking at that. Our study will really be trying to figure out if there's a way to use our process to try to get at healthcare costs, whatever that looks like. If there's a way to do that and get at the hidden tax, we're certainly open to doing that. Part of the reason we want to do the study is really to review what options might be out there in terms of getting at those costs. But the cost shifting is, if you talk to insurers, it's a huge issue. It's an absolutely real issue. And I don't know how you get the information you really need on that. I've been asked that by other legislators, and we certainly don't capture that information in the data we have. So I wish I had a better answer for you. I don't know how you get at that.
Thank you. You're finished?
I
figured before we start with Mr. Fitzpatrick, as I mentioned, he has a strong reputation as being a very good actuary and a very straight shooter. And so I thought I'd read some of his biography here from the web. Scott Fitzpatrick has been a fellow with the Society of Actuaries since 1998 with a Bachelor of Science degree in Physics from the U.S. Naval Academy. Prior to joining the department in 2001, Mr. Fitzpatrick spent almost 16 years as an actuary with Standard Insurance in Portland, Oregon. Upon joining the department, Mr. Fitzpatrick worked with other division staff to aggressively address a backlog of health rate filings. So we really appreciate you walking us through how this process works, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe everybody has the document in front of them entitled Small Group Rate Filing for Rates Effective October 2010, and this was a specific source small group rate filing that impacted 35,000 Oregonians.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is attached to my testimony. It's the last page in my testimony document.
Okay, this is a process that involves a dozen steps, and what it is designed to do is to generate a statistic or estimator of what the necessary rate increase is for the product line to run at the desired profit level for the upcoming contracted period. And so in row A, we have, it's the experience period was selected to be February 2009 through January 2010. And since they're submitting for an October 1st, 2010 effective date, they need to have that 12-month period let the claims be paid out so that they can get the most accurate estimate of the claims that were paid during that period. And then they filed this in May 2010 because they realized it takes 30 to 60 days to get an approval through the Oregon Insurance Division, and then it takes 2 to 4 months for them to implement the rate increase and get the notice to the policyholders. So line B is the earned premium, and I'm not going to give the nine digits. I'll just say approximately $103 million of earned premium. And then line C, what the company does is they have to take everybody who's paying their premium during that experience period and bring them up to the rate that is currently charged, because we want one rate. We don't want several different rates in that period. And so they increase that number to $113 million of earned premium. Actually, it's $114 million of earned premium. Then line D is the raw incurred claims for experience period, and that's what they actually paid out, about $92 million in claims during that same 12-month period that lines up with the earned premium that was collected. And then the company pooled claims over $200,000 amount per individual, and then they also adjusted it for any change in the demographics during the experience period. So they actually lowered the incurred claims to $86 million. Now their trend assumption was 12.8%, and because we have to go from the midpoint of the experience period, and that's going to be August 1st, 2009, 20 months later, all the way through April 1st of 2011, because that's the midpoint of the contractual period where they'll sell the new premium rates. And that increases the incurred claims 22% to a trended claims for the experience period value of $105 million. Then the company has an approximately 15% administrative load that adds $22.6 million to that total. And so the company projects that it must collect premium of $128 million through as of October 1st, 2010 through September 30th, 2012 for that group of people. And so that loss ratio is 112%, but that means we only need to increase premiums 12.4%. And then on row J, the company has trimmed that back and says, we believe we can earn our target profit by just increasing rates 9.06%. And then the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act added 2.2% of additional benefits, so they bring that into their equation, and they're going to request an 11.88% rate increase. Earlier in that 12-month period, they did have a small rate increase, so the total year-over-year rate increase is 15.4%. And, you know, this was a 169-page rate filing. This is the crux of the matter. They did have several dozen pages of rate tables. I review them for consistency, but they really do not add any value to my analysis.
Questions?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Mr. Fitzpatrick, for condensing 169 pages to one. I kind of lost you at line F with what the how you got the trended claims amount. I was following until there, and then I kind of missed what trended meant.
The company has a 12.8% trend assumption. And I gave this formula to Teresa a week or two ago, and it added no value. So, Senator Bombanici, Mr. Chair, I apologize. But what we're doing is we're taking the value 1.128 and raising it to the 20 slash divided by 12 power. That makes perfect sense to me. I don't expect you to understand or appreciate that, but that's how we get there.
Thank you.
And we load the 86 million claims in row E by 22%, and that gets it up to the 106 million.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Teresa. You used to be in public affairs here. Okay. In English, I hear another 12% number. Is there a correlation between what we're saying here, that we anticipate the costs are going to go up 12%, and what we think the inflation average was is 12%? Those two are the same thing, aren't we?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, yes.
Okay. Well,
Senator Boquist.
And we're back at the issue of, you know, that 12% is what's driving our costs, sir. And being able to identify those, Mr. Chair, I don't know, from days in revenue committee, I mean, if I were a business and I do mission-to-mission analysis of costs, I mean, I compare, you know, I put the apples all in a row and start looking line by line across my, you know, my tax filing data and say, okay, this is going up here. At your level in the insurance division, do you have the access to the information to say it's not just Doc Jones charging more or this guy charging more? Do we have any analysis of all that can tell us where that 12% is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, you're actually getting at the issue that a lot of people are starting to ask this question of us. And historically, I think insurance regulators, typically you look at what premium amount is coming in and the amount being spent on claims. You don't look at where it's going. But one of the things that we're doing as part of our first rate review grant is we're trying to break down those claims costs to get at exactly, I think, what you're talking about. We don't see the contracts between insurers and providers today, but part of what we're trying to look at is how do those, because we don't know, and I don't think consumers of the world or you all know, how do those claims costs break down? What percent is going to hospitals? What percent is going to pharmacy benefits? How do they break out? And we don't get that today, but that is something that we are literally having advisory committees about right now, and we'll be adopting rules to try to figure out how to break down those claims costs.
Follow up, Senator Boquist.
So just to clarify and understand, then, what I got from your presentation, and I appreciate the financial side of it, for a naval grad, I mean, you lost me completely, but I'm here. I'm just an Army grunt. I'm fine. I got it. It is that, you know, the insurance companies that you're regulating aren't making a huge profit out here. They're not the ones that are the problem, whatever the problem is. The other thing we hear is we don't know what we don't know, and back to my fine glib comment about the CPI, I mean, maybe hypothetically, I don't think this is the case, but hypothetically it could be, you know, a balance of costs that really do equal 12% someplace. But we don't know whether it's real inflation. We don't know whether it's a specific subset of the medical costs that are driving these up. And you have 49 counterparts out there doing pretty much the same thing you're doing, and nobody seems to have the answer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I think the insurers could tell you line by line where the money's going. They know exactly where it's going because they're paying those claims, but we don't get that information. That's correct.
And Mr. Fitzpatrick, you've done several of the examinations of the health insurers. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I perform an estimate of the unpaid claims liability, but I do not do financial examinations.
You don't do the exams. So, I mean, when you do an examination, wouldn't that be something that you would look at during the exam period of when you're going through their financials?
What would we be looking at?
How much of the dollars went to hospitals? How much went to the various categories?
Mr. Chair, we do see where the money goes in terms of some categories, but in terms of whether it's going to hospital, we don't break it down that way. We know how much is going for large group business, for example. We know how much is their Medicare Advantage business, but we don't have that breakdown in the financial exams, to my knowledge.
Senator George.
Mr. Fitzpatrick, thank you very much. You lost me on line K, and you said it really quick, so I'm trying to figure out. It says total increase including impact of mandates and other factor changes, and you said some kind of act added 2%.
Right. It was, Mr. Chair, Senator George, it was PPACA. It's Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that was passed March 23rd, 2010, and it's has about five segments. I'm not prepared to list them all.
Follow up. So do you always track, like, I think we have something now in state statute of like 45 state mandates on health insurance. Do you guys track the costs, additional costs of the state legislature on these plans based on the mandates that we pass?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we do occasionally. We have had a data call in the recent past, but we don't like to do data calls. And I did speak with, I think there was mental health parity that was passed a few years back, and I asked the actuary at an insurer, and he said, we just don't have time to track all that, and he said it's not actionable anyway, so they didn't feel it was there would be value added. So we do on occasion, but not every time.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Amici.
Thank you. And I have one more question. I wanted to understand how you got from line K's 11.88% to line L 15.4%. And I believe you said that there was another increase, so I just want to understand,
Mr. Chair,
how you
Senator,
went from that the from line K to line L.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Bamanichi, yes, there was. Carriers can either file annually or quarterly, and this carrier had filed for a small 2 to 3% rate increase earlier in the year. And so when you went from October 1st, 2009 to October 1st, 2010, you had a 3 to 4% rate increase on top of the 11.88% rate increase, and it would compound to 15.4%.
So now I have a follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know if you have a figure, but typically how many rate increases would the average insurer request per year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bamanichi, it varies by carrier. Some carriers like to come in every quarter for a rate increase, and some just figure once in every 12-month period is good for them. But with the 12% trend rate, one carrier has actually said it's too steep to not get quarterly rate increases. The person who buys late in the year is getting too much of a bargain as opposed to the person who buys earlier in the 12-month rate period.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, just to add to that, an individual policyholder is not going to get an increase more than once a year, but the insurance
right.
is coming. Okay,
right.
Just to be clear.
And, Teresa and Mr. Fitzpatrick, some insurers make requests quarterly. Do you have to do a full rate filing for that insurer then four times per year?
And Mr. Chair, every rate increase is thoroughly scrutinized. It doesn't matter how frequently they submit the rate increase.
And as most of you know, the overwhelming majority of the budget in DCBS is regulatory fees and assessments. For an insurer that comes in and says, I want four filings in the small group, they have to pay four times as much as somebody who comes in once per year?
Mr. Chair, I don't think that's how it works. It's based on, and I haven't spent as much time on this as I should, but it's the assessment is based on how much staff time we've spent on a particular line of insurance. So health insurance, for example, all health carriers are going to deal with however much time our staff spends on it. And then I think it's premium. It's based on premium.
Yes, on premium. Okay.
So.
Could you get us a breakdown of how much the top seven carriers pay in assessments in biennium? Then I had a question. You have a list of the statutes. Are these all the statutes that you consider when determining whether or not to approve or disapprove a rate request?
Mr. Chair, no. There's significant ones that tell how the rating factors and attributes have to line up and compare to one another, and those are just the major statutes.
Okay. There's the other one that describes whether or not something is prejudicial. Is that still in, or was that changed in House Bill 2009?
Oh, it was not changed in House Bill 2009. That was 742005. And did we not include that? It's a form statute that we've been using for rate filings. So if we didn't include that, 742005 is still in effect.
Okay. So can you walk us through maybe the four criteria that you look for when determining whether or not something meets the statutory requirements? What are those in a nutshell?
Mr. Chair, I think that's what I did in my presentation in terms of there are a number of factors that we talked about. I think that's really what they're looking at, and then looking at the insurer's assumptions around those factors. And that's all used to determine whether or not it meets those statutory requirements.
You said the only one I really remember is reasonable. What are the other statutory requirements?
Mr. Chair, there's one that's not unfairly discriminatory. I wish I had that statute in front of me.
Yeah.
The two major statutes that I...
Should be part of your testimony, right?
Oh.
743-018.
Mr. Chair, are you referring to the reasonable and not excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory language?
Yes, I guess so.
Mr. Chair, there's six subsets to 742-005, and I don't have them committed to memory. I know how to work with them, and I apologize.
Okay. So if it hasn't changed, one of them is if in the director's judgment its use would be prejudicial to the interests of the insurer's policyholders. Does that sound about right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
How do we figure out whether or not something's prejudicial?
Mr. Chair, I would consider that if it would cause harm to the consumer. And that doesn't answer your question, I admit, but that is probably the most elusive subset of 742-005.
Okay. So you've got a fair amount of discretion in this process. Okay, that's fair enough. That's all I wanted to know. Any other questions, colleagues? Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Nice job. And I also wanted to commend the division for the rulemaking process. I think I should do that as well. In House Bill 2009, Oregon our Administrator Miller was talking about how we're paving the way. In that rulemaking process, DCBS decided that a health insurer could not redact key parts of their rate filings. And so I think that was a very good strike for transparency, and I really appreciate the work of the division there. All right. And then moving along into the agenda, we have next a report on analysis of health insurance rate reviews. Laura Etherton from the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. And you may recall, Osberg was the winner of the $100,000 contract from the insurance division, and we've asked Laura to just kind of update us on what she proposed to do in the proposal, what they've done so far, and what they plan to do in the future. Welcome to the committee.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's nice to be here. My name is Laura Etherton. Again, I'm the health policy advocate with Osberg and Osberg Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today about a topic that I think we can all agree is fascinating, sometimes mind-melting in its complexity, but could not be more important to the daily lives of consumers and businesses around us every day who are facing health insurance costs that they can't afford and in many times are holding them back. So a little bit of background. Osberg is a statewide nonprofit, nonpartisan consumer advocacy organization. We were founded in 1971, and we've had a 40-year history now of working on consumer protection issues and advocating for consumers on a range of issues, ranging from financial issues to healthcare issues, from democracy and voting to budget transparency. Osberg Foundation is Osberg's sister organization that focuses on research, policy, public education. So in mid-November of this past year, Osberg Foundation launched the Health Insurance Rate Watch project. And through this project, our staff are tracking and analyzing rate filings in Oregon. And conducting in-depth analysis and providing detailed comments on a subset of those filings and submitting those to the Oregon Insurance Division and also making those publicly available. Really excited about this project and very grateful and honored for the grant that is enabling us to put the actuarial expertise and the staff time that's needed to really do the detailed analysis of these health insurance rate filings from a consumer perspective, and also to reach out to consumers, to businesses, and other folks in Oregon to engage more people in the process of reviewing these rates and making their comments known. As Senator Boquist commented, the day when you get the letter about your rates going up, it's a little too late. And so engaging more people in the process as these rates are still pending is exactly the time when it's important to reach out and get folks involved. So a little bit about the project. The main pieces of the project are developing and implementing a methodology to actually track the insurance rate requests and have a concrete way to do the more detailed policy analysis and create the comments, encouraging more businesses and consumers to be engaged in the process. As part of that, we're establishing an advisory committee of businesses and organizations who can, in a sense, peer review our work, both folks who are just actually getting these rate increases and also folks who have specific expertise in this area, and continually refine our efforts as we go along. Progress to date, we dedicated most of November and December to really digging down and establishing the project and creating that methodology. We quickly moved to sort of beta testing our methodology by doing comments on the rate filing. So we looked at the United Healthcare rate filing, and that's actually the second stapled document right after the testimony. So we did a detailed analysis of the United Healthcare rate filing and submitted comments on that on December 16th. And then as part of that as well, in addition to our own senior staff at Osberg, we also contracted with an actuary both to review the filing as well and make comments, and also to advise us on our methodology to make sure that we are getting this right. We want to, at the end of this year, have a project that can continue with as lean a way as possible in terms of funding so that we can continue the benefits of this into the future. Right now we are in the process of analyzing the second rate filing that we are planning on doing comments on. That's the Health Net rate filing, and those comments are due on Saturday, but we'll get them done on Friday. And that rate request is we're completing the comments on that right now. So that's where we are in the process. And a little bit, I'd love to walk you through a little bit about the comments and how we're approaching our analysis, if that would be of interest to the committee. But I also want to be cognizant of the amount of time that you have on this issue.
Thank you, Laura. I think what I would, it's great to go there, and then if you could walk us through with a little more detail what your findings were and your opinion of the United Healthcare filing, that would be helpful too.
Sure. Okay. So looking at the United Healthcare Insurance Company filing, the executive summary kind of summarizes our opinion about the filing, and this was an interesting case because in many respects the United Healthcare filing is not one where the filing itself adequately justified the rate increase, and in fact did not adequately provide the necessary documentation to justify their trend assumptions or even actually literally make the case for their rate increase. They made good arguments for sections of rate increases and defended them, but never actually defended the full rate increase. So it was we hope is an unusual rate filing in that respect, and are looking forward to being able to dive into some that do actually give background information that justifies the rate increases. But going through a little bit more of the other details in the rate filing, the first step we do is we look at the sort of basic features of the rate filing. What's the average rate increase? What's the low end of the rate increase? What's the high end of the rate increase that people might see? What's the insurer's history of rate increases in the market? Are we seeing, in this case, for example, it's been 14.3%, 14.10, 18.8. We're seeing, a pretty steady high rate increases there. Also looking at the number of Oregonians impacted is a significant one. And looking at a couple of key little factors in terms of what's the percent increase in medical costs that would be reflected by the rate increase, and what's the percent increase in administrative costs as well. In terms of the next section we look at is a little bit more about the insurer information. Some insurance companies are headquartered nationally. Some are domiciled in Oregon. Some have a parent company that is significantly far away. Some are right here in Oregon. There's a blending there, and then a little bit more about the insurer's financial information and their history. Next, we move on to more detail of the discussion of the rate filing itself, where we look at the, as you've discussed here today, the real meat of the problem with the rising cost of healthcare is the rising cost of healthcare. So insurance costs are going up because health insurance, healthcare costs are going up. So looking at medical and drug cost trends. And also very importantly, and I think this is one of the things we really applaud the insurance division and the Oregon legislature for making sure that this went into the factors that are looked at in terms of rate review, what is the insurance company doing to help actually reduce costs while improving care? What are they doing to actually make that trend line go a little less steeply? And while some of that is significant, is not in the power of the insurance company. It's out in the provider community. It's what hospitals are choosing to do. It's what doctors are choosing to do and what patients are choosing to do. Some of that is in the insurance company's power in terms of how they are encouraging folks in their provider network to focus on prevention, focus on chronic disease management, because things that we know actually, if done correctly, save money and actually make people healthier. Other aspects we can look at are just the increase in administrative costs and where the insurance company is actually looking to cut the waste. And honestly, from our perspective, if they're doing a great job cutting the waste, doing an efficient job, people are getting healthy, we're fine with insurance companies making profits. What it's really about is, can we actually afford the product here in Oregon that they're selling, and we can move from there. So that's a key piece. Moving ahead, we look at the benefits, the actual changes to the benefit structure. For example, if the rates are going up but the benefits are going down, that's a little bit of a flag. So, okay, if the benefits are going down, the rates are going up, but the person's going to have a lot higher of a deductible, what's that going to mean for that family, and what's that going to mean in terms of what the person puts off that care and ends up in the emergency room and ends up costing us all a lot more money later. So key factors there. In the case of United, we looked at, they actually are doing a fairly significant job focusing on some of the key pieces on reducing costs while improving quality. And we wanted to give the company credit for doing that, and they're also participating in some efforts to actually track that information. What was interesting in our in looking at that is that the company also estimated that their work to reduce costs would actually reduce claims costs by about $9.40 per member per month, and yet it was difficult to see how that then impact, how that wove into their request to increase rates by 16.8% as part of that rate filing. So how those two connect will be an important piece as we move forward.
And Laura, can you give us a little background of how United got into the Oregon market? Do you know?
Actually, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't know that story.
But they bought Pacific Care, right? Wasn't that how they entered this market? No? Well, we'll have somebody from AHIP here in coming weeks. They can tell us this story.
I'm so sorry not to have the information for you today. I can find that out though and get back to you on that. One of the other pieces that we look at as we move forward into the detail.
Actually, we just had a representative from United Health who can answer that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Beth Slater with CFM. I represent United Healthcare, and you are right, Mr. Chair, that United Healthcare entered the committee by purchasing Pacific Care a few years ago. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Moving forward, another issue that we look at when reviewing the rate filings, in addition to the all-important problem of the rising cost of prescription drugs and the actual care itself. We do also look at the administrative costs of the insurance company. While it is a much smaller percentage of the premium dollar, it is still a significant amount of money, and if we can get more efficiency there, that's good news for the consumer. One of the things that's an interesting trend that we've seen in this rate filing and in some others is that the increase in the As the increase in the premium goes up, you would imagine that that would be reflected in the portion of the premium that gets spent on medical claims. You know, that, yeah, it's rising 16%. You know, 16% might go to medical claims. But what we're also seeing is that the increase in the administrative costs are also going up by about the same amount as the overall premium increase. In other words, administrative costs, which you'd think wouldn't track quite as closely with medical trend, but more closely with regular CPI or just larger cost of living, you'd imagine a much slower rise in terms of the administrative costs. That isn't, in fact, what we're seeing in very many of the filings. In fact, in the HealthNet filing that we're looking at right now, the administrative costs as a percentage of the premium from last year to the proposed filing actually is higher than in the medical costs. Now, that might be justified. There may be some real good reasons for that, but I think one of the important things that we're seeing in the rate filings is the fact of that happening, and then one of the pieces that is required in the law is for the insurance companies to justify why that would be the case, and for the insurance division to determine whether or not that's really reasonable, and to push back on that a bit. So that's that piece, and then we also look at the stability of the plan and the insurer. It's great if costs can go down, but if that means insurance companies are collapsing and leaving policyholders holding the bag, that's not very helpful. So of course that's a key factor, as Administrator Miller mentioned. That's not the problem that we're seeing really with Oregon insurers. Mostly the rates are. It's not that the rates are too low; it's that the rates are too high. The final piece that we look at is the affordability of the product and what that means for Oregonians. When you look at a rate filing, and there's hundreds of pages of plan relativities and rating factors, and what this really means for an Oregon business in Estacada versus one in Portland versus a big company versus a smaller company with older employees versus younger employees, and how many of them smoke and which ones don't, and do they have a wellness program, and all these different factors. The real impacts of these rate increases are something we want to look at. Now, we can't analyze that for every single Oregonian who would be impacted by the rate. That'd be, in this case, about 38,000 folks, but we do want to look at a few consumer profiles. So we created a couple of consumer profiles. One is a small company. One's a more medium-sized, and one's a little bit, of a larger size. And then we looked at, with different average rate, different average ages as part of their plans, as part of their employees, and then compared that with what would their monthly premium be with the same plan in the most inexpensive, the most expensive in sort of a median geographic area in the state. So comparing a little bit of that and looking at the employee rate versus the employee plus spouse rate. And if that's on page 7 of the analysis, you can see the difference between, the employee rate for a young person would be $467 per month in the most expensive, and there's not too much variation in the geography, but if you look at the family rate with a much older average age mix, the rate really, as you can see, is about three times as much as what you see for someone at the younger
Laura,
age.
Laura, what page is that on?
That's on page 7. And this is an area where we had hoped to be able to really compare apples to apples across health insurance carriers, to be able to say, okay, here's this about the same plan. So you could actually do this same calculation across United Healthcare, across Health Net, across Providence, and say, okay, how what's the interaction across carriers as well? There is so little uniformity in the types of plans that are available to people that we're having a challenge coming up with sort of the typical plan. But we are continuing to find this the process of taking the rate filing and really trying and really doing the math on what will this mean for a company that meets this, you know, certain set of profile requirements. That's been a really helpful piece. Right now we're looking at the United one and saying, okay, say the younger group also has more smokers, what does that do to their rates? And that's been a really instructive piece and puts a little bit of a at least a theoretical face on these rate increases for us. So again, we ended up concluding on the United Healthcare rate increase that we concluded that they did not appear to justify the rate increase in this particular case, and that they did not appear to justify the trend assumptions, and that we also noted that the rise in administrative costs exceeded the producer price index which is a marker in this factor in this area and did not then justify the reason for that. So we had a number of concerns with this one, and it'll be interesting to see as we move forward with other rate filings how they compare.
Excuse me, Laura. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this question is better directed to Teresa, but Laura, how and when do you communicate this information to the people at the division who are doing the rate review? Do you communicate it in the form of like this kind of report, and do you go present it at a time when they can consider it when they're doing their own rate review? I'm just trying to figure out the relationship between what you're doing and what the department is doing.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Senator Bonamici, that is an excellent question. The way that the insurance division has set up the process for this project and for comments on rate filings overall is one, to make sure that those comments can then be used before the insurance company makes their final determination. So once a rate filing is determined to be complete, it is then posted on the website, and if you've signed up, you get an email telling you that there's been a new rate filing posted.
If I could stop you there,
absolutely.
You know what you all might want to think about? It's really easy to do. You go to the insurance division, click on sign up for the email, click 5 or 6 of them, and then you'll get an email sent to your phone whenever it's going to happen. You can see kind of in real time over the next couple of weeks how this works.
Absolutely.
Sure, your assumption is I get an email on my phone.
you can have it flown out to you by pigeon. And go ahead, Laura.
Thank you, Senator. From that point, there's a 30-day public comment period. And in that time frame, we prepare the comments and actually also do the outreach to broad consumers and the advisory committee, and we submit those comments by the 30-day deadline, and then the insurance division has at least another 10 days and sometimes longer depending on the details.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know this is a fairly new project. Has there been one of the rate review processes where your organization has commented and then the insurance division has considered your comments, and if so, did they incorporate your comments? Did they follow up on them? Did they challenge them? I'm just trying to figure out how much impact your work is having on the division.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, we've only submitted one set of comments so far. And the division is required to consider all comments made by us or made by any consumer or business on their website as part of their consideration. We are in regular contact with the division, but I think the question of how our comments will impact their final decision is a question best directed at to the division themselves.
I do have a question for you. One, on page 3, you say there's insufficient data to support the medical trend. If you have, part of the theme here is that that I pick up in this is that we didn't have enough information to analyze this sufficiently, that sufficiently. Do you have the opportunity to ask the insurance division or United directly, hey, I'd like to see this, and this before I can make a real comment? Or are you expected to just look at what's on the web and that's it?
Mr. Chair, that is an excellent question and one that we are in the process of figuring out an answer to. Honestly, when we first looked at this first filing, we thought, gosh, there is a lot of information that we don't have here. For example, an example of this is while an insurance company does file the specifics about the benefits the first time that they offer them, they don't then refile them as part of the rate filing every time they increase the rate or make adjustments. They note when they've made adjustments to the benefits, but they don't refile sort of the original set of the original contract around that benefit structure. So that is a piece of information that the insurance division has, and they have indicated to us, yes, of course, if you request that, we can give you that information. We have that information. It's just not part of the filing because we already have it. And so I think through this process, we're realizing, okay, for an ordinary consumer, it's very hard for them to, or a consumer organization like ours, to be able to evaluate that without the information and to know, okay, that's where that goes, and in the future, perhaps there's a way for that information to be more readily available.
Okay. Good. And we've got about, what do you think, about 5 more minutes and we can still get everything done? Or should we ask her to wrap it up in the next couple? Patrick?
You were going to have one other presentation.
Oh, yeah, we got the MedVal. Oh, my gosh. All right. So we have to speed up. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the sample case, United Healthcare here, and the date timeline you provided, can you tell us what you recommended? What did you and your actuary recommend? What did the department do, and what was approved? Because you said 16.8 is too high. What did you guys come up with a number, and then what did the department do finally?
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, in this project, in this particular case, and I think in many of the cases, we do not feel that that we have the expertise to come up with the number that it ought to be, because we are commenting on the rate filing as it is, and oftentimes do not have the full information that one would need to say what the rate increase instead ought to be. And in this particular case, because there wasn't that full information about what the medical trends and some of the other pieces, we did not make a recommendation on that.
Do you know what the agency did?
The agency, I believe, has not made a final decision on this rate filing.
One final follow-up.
Yes, Senator Boquist.
And if you go to page 4, I'm trying to understand it here, but if you look at the percentage of premium spent on medical costs is 85.4%, and the percentage spent on administrative costs is 17.5%, which equals 103%. I think there's a mathematical error here and some calculations that aren't particularly accurate. Thank you.
And then, Laura, so as far as the statutory...
I'd love to...
feel free.
This,
didn't know you had a comment.
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, this is one of the cases where the insurance company is having a loss on this line of business. And so the difference between those two, as you're duly noting, they're operating at a loss in this line of business. And that's why the numbers do not add up to what you might expect.
Just a quick follow-up from the chair.
Quick, please.
Just so I understand, so... We know the rate increase didn't appear to be justified, but we know they're losing money. Am I following the train here? I don't want Teresa's job. I know that. That's kind of what we're saying, right? The lack of information.
But there are a lot of assumptions that are being made in a rate file.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, that's correct.
How much more do you got?
Glad we're senators.
Are you done?
Thanks so much for the opportunity to here before you today.
Okay, great. Thank you for coming, Laura. All right, colleagues, we're going to shift into overdrive here. And one of the things that we need to make some decisions or not about in the next several months is about medical malpractice insurance. And so I thought I'd ask the director or the administrator, Ms. Miller, to come back up and tell us about trends in medical malpractice insurance. And if I recall, this was going to be a pretty short presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I was asked to be here just very briefly to share the trend in medical professional liability insurance rates. This market tends to be cyclical, and rates have been declining in recent years. Rates for the Oregon's two largest insurers have gone down an average of 20% since 2006. And I attached to my testimony a chart that is probably the best thing I can leave you with, illustrating the trend in medical professional liability insurance rates over the last 10 years. And I think the chart really does kind of speak for itself in terms of where rates have been. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
That was some very brilliant testimony, I must say. Senator Boquist.
I think just looking at the chart here to make sure I understand, they're going down, but they're still going up, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist,
they're above the 100% line. Okay.
They're going down, but they have not gone down to the levels they were at in 1999 and 2000. So the recent trend is to go down, but they have not gotten back to where they were 10 years ago.
But they're still rising at a constant. It shows here that year to year they're still going up. They're still above 100%. Am I making the right thing here?
I think so.
What's the x-axis?
Yes.
On the chart?
Yes.
What's your x-axis?
Right thing, right,
yes.
Yes. Yeah,
the percentage change.
They're down, but they're still
above 100%, so it's
these are the actual rates. These aren't increases. So these are the actual rates where they started in 1999, and then where they've been. So you're correct that they haven't gotten back to where they were in 1999. They've gone up to 200% of what they were in 1999. They've come back down, but they haven't gone down below 100% of where they were in 1999.
Yeah, follow up.
I'm a farmer and an infantry guy. I got to have this simpler. They're still above 100%, right? Which means they're still increasing, but gradually. They're increasing at a less rate, kind of like our budget. They're not going up as much as we think it is going up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, they're going down. So this is actually the trend of the rates over the last 10 years. So they started at zero in 1999. They went up to 200, and they're now going back down. So the rates are actually going down.
It's a mislabeled chart.
Sorry.
It's a percent of the change off of the 99 year.
Right. Right.
So that chart is a percent change from 1999.
Right.
And maybe just to get on the go ahead.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
Get on the record, these... could you read the
sure.
2010 line for these
sure,
two
Mr. Chair. So
carriers?
In 2006, the Doctor's Company had an 8.3% decrease, and Continental Casualty, that's the official name, Continental Casualty Company, had a 1.9% increase. In 2007, the Doctor's Company had a 10.2% decrease, and Continental Casualty had a 3.2% decrease. 2008, Doctor's Company had an 8.9% decrease, and Continental Casualty had a 7.6% decrease. 2009, the Doctor's Company had a zero, basically no change. Continental Casualty had a 2.5% decrease. 2010, the Doctor's Company had a 5.1% decrease, and Continental Casualty had zero. Had essentially no change.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much, Administrator Miller. We really appreciate all the work that you and your staff are doing, and particularly Mr. Fitzpatrick. I know he is there to stand up for small business and the individual market, as well as make sure that our companies are solvent, and we very much appreciate his work.
Thanks.
Okay, colleagues, we're going to move on to two quick bills and then some introduction of committee bills. So we're going to have a public hearing and possible work session, but I think we'll move them on Senate Bill 52. We have representatives from DAS here. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Robin Harpster. I'm the Facilities Administrator for the Department of Administrative Services. And before you today, I am presenting Senate Bill 52. Senate Bill 52 is a housekeeping bill which expands methods of advertising to give notice of proposed sale of state real property. Currently, the state statute requires state agencies to provide notice of real property sales to in newspapers for 3 successive weeks to solicit our opportunity for real property sales for the state. If the property doesn't sell within an 18-month period, by statute we're required to re-advertise specifically in a newspaper for the sale of real property for the state. We've surveyed state agencies, sister state agencies that own land, and asked the viability of just newspapers alone and the success of that solely as the source to advertise, and have indicated thus far that we have not had successful real property sales in that medium alone. What we've proposed with this housekeeping bill is to expand the offering of advertisements not only to newspapers but to all forms of medium, including agency websites, Craigslist, Business Oregon, local economic development firms, depending on the type of real property sale that the state is looking to sell. In addition to that, the bill also allows an exemption after the 18-month period. That re-advertising, as I just mentioned earlier, as long as agencies are aggressively marketing through Business Oregon or local economic development firms, that they not have to re-advertise in just newspapers alone. Okay. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Great. And by the way, colleagues, I thought we were going to move this today, but we're not because we're way down the fiscal, but we'll be able to move it hopefully shortly hereafter. Any questions? All right, then I will... I didn't officially open a public hearing on this, so we'll open
public
consent. Implied consent. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 52, and as soon as we get the fiscal back, we'll move this in the next day or so. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 53. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Fred Lord. I work for the Department of Administrative Services Facilities Division. I'm a property transactions coordinator. I'm here to speak about Senate Bill 53, which is regarding the charitable fund drive, which is run by state employees as volunteers. The bill is basically a housekeeping or cleanup bill, which will clean up legacy issues that haven't been an actual fact for a number of years. The current statute that allows the Charitable Fund Drive Committee to operate refers to the United Fund, which hasn't been an entity operating in Oregon for a number of years. In addition, the current statute does not give the Charitable Fund Drive contracting authority to hire the management firm, which it has been hiring for many cycles. And this will recognize current practice. And with that, I'm open to your questions.
Excellent. I'm a big fan of concision. Thank you very much. Any questions? Great. Well, we'd appreciate it as soon as we get the fiscal back.
This one we can move.
Oh, we do have it. Okay, good. All right. Well, I will close the is there anybody else to testify on this bill? All right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 53 and open a work session on Senate Bill 53.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 53 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 53 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I'll vote for it as long as I don't have to carry it.
I think as general rule, we'll call the roll.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
And Chair
Shields? Aye. Measure passes. Senator Boquist, would you carry this bill on the floor?
What you get for opening
All right.
See, but I'm going to carry a simple one.
All right, colleagues, and we have the matter of introduction of committee measures.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
I want to know why, you know, 3 people came down here from DAS. And you know, 2 of them spoke to us, and Marjorie. I thought maybe they just brought her along for window dressing. Okay. All right.
And to keep us in check.
Capital power
yes.
player.
All right. So I don't have to open anything.
I'll open a work session okay. just for...
I'll open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee member measures. Who's going to make the motion?
It's up to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. There you go. Mr. Vice Chair.
Can I just move... Okay. Do I have to list each one?
At least by number, Mr. All right. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, LC 101, LC 1243, LC 1280, LC 1307, LC 14... Let me just say what's in the record here. LC 1436, LC 1664, LC 1669, LC 1859, LC 2014, LC 2028, LC 2608, LC 2613, LC 2669, LC 2775, LC 2778, LC 2860, LC 2940.
Senator George moves that the LCs as listed be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Bonamici.
I wonder if you're going to give the sort of cautionary
preamble
that a vote to introduce these LC drafts is to get them into the system does not necessarily imply support for each and every LC that we're supporting to get into the system.
Well said.
Yes.
and Mr. Chair, I agree with Senator Mullins.
That is the case. You're not indicating support or opposition.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Colleagues, thank you very much for sticking with us. A couple minutes late. This meeting is adjourned.
We're not due 53.
All right.